Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. Science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. We have a fun show for you this morning. Our first guest, Brian McInerney, hydrologist for the National Weather Service. And this morning, we're going to talk about the weather. Lynn, you remember the good old days when if somebody brought up weather, it was because there was nothing else to talk about?
That happens sometimes now, still.
Well, I tell you what, things have changed. Severe weather and climate change are front and center on our minds.
That's right. Well, our second guest this morning is Zeng Zeng, an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah. A University of Utah-led team discovered a hypervelocity star that is the closest, second brightest, and among the largest of 20 found so far. Speeding at more than a million miles per hour, the star may provide clues about the supermassive black hole at the center of our Milky Way and the halo of mysterious dark matter surrounding the galaxy. We've talked about dark matter before on this show.
There's
more than you would think about dark matter.
They say that 80% of the universe is dark matter.
That's right. So this finding out or discovering things that can tell us more about it is very worthy and interesting. And Zeng Zeng promises to speak in layperson's terms.
So cool science.
Stay with us. Only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Proudly supporting KPCW, Cushman & Wakefield Commerce offers commercial real estate services, including property management and valuation, for companies and investors throughout the Intermountain West. Located at Kimball Junction in the Park City Tech Center, we can be reached at 435-575-5600 or online at comre.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Right at Home, 1745 Bonanza Drive, Furniture and Home Accessories Consignment. Gallery Mar, fresh contemporary art on Main Street, gallerymar.com. Rally Interactive makes apps, websites, and other digital products, rallyinteractive.com. Dumond Gourmet, prepared global gourmet meals, pickup or delivery, dumondgourmet.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest is Brian McInerney, hydrologist for the National Weather Service. Well, it's been pretty quiet on the weather front lately. And Lynn, that's sarcasm.
Yeah, I thought so.
Torrential downpours in the east, destructive tornadoes in the Midwest, a polar vortex this past winter that put 20 states into mom's stand-up freezer, and of course, drought and wildfires in the west. 2 weeks ago, the White House released an 800-page report authored by 300 scientists stating climate change is not in the future. It's here today. And last week, a report was issued stating Western Antarctic ice sheets are melting at an accelerated pace. And yesterday, NASA released a report stating El Niño, last seen in 1997, may be visiting us again this winter. Our next guest will help us understand the sea of madness. Brian, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, this is an exciting time to be a hydrologist.
Oh, it really is. You know, all you have to do is look back in July, August, to September, southern Utah and Colorado. We broke the record for the amount of flash flood warnings we issued. We had flash flooding all over the place. They actually doubled the amount of warnings we issued. And that's just due to what we saw for thunderstorms that were phenomenal rain events, intense, that produced flows that we haven't seen in quite some time. And it was over a three-month period. So every day we would go in and we would get geared up and we kind of knew what we were faced. And then when the thunderstorm started, we would just see widespread flooding all over. And then that ended in the floods in Colorado that destroyed so many homes and really wreaked havoc in Colorado.
And we were speaking before the show, and you were telling me that actual precipitation is only notched up slightly. So what we're talking about is more rain in within a shorter amount of time that would cause this flooding. So my friends in Boston tell me that they've never seen rainstorms so hard and fast in the Boston area before. So that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
More rain in a shorter period of time.
Yeah. And actually, when you look at the Wasatch Mountains, that's what's happening in the storms coming out of the Pacific Northwest. The storms are less frequent. There's not as many of them, but they're more intense because our precipitation has remained pretty much the same. The fraction of precipitation is changing where it's increasingly getting more rainfall than we've seen in the past as opposed to snow. But the overall volume really hasn't changed. And when you look at the amount of storms as they're less, that would indicate that we've got more intense storms when they do hit us.
So what is it, Brian, that is creating, I mean, if you were to dissect a storm cloud, for example, what is it that is allowing more, you know, water to fall out of the sky in more intense amounts over shorter durations?
The theory is if you have a warmer atmosphere, you can hold more moisture. So now you have the moisture in the atmosphere, and it just takes a little bit of dynamics. It could be heating, like we see in thunderstorms in the summertime, where you heat the ground, and then that air right above the ground becomes less dense, and it starts to rise. And as it rises, it starts to cool. And if you have in that air parcel more moisture, then you're going to get a bigger thunderstorm. And then when it reaches the point where it precipitates out, you're going to get a lot more precipitation out of that cloud. Whereas on a dry day, you might just get cloud formations. And then when the upper part of that cloud starts to precipitate out, the bottom part of the cloud is still dry, so you get a lot of wind. So when you see a big wind event here during thunderstorm season, know that it's the moisture in the cloud that's coming down and pressing the air column down to the ground and then spreading it out. When we have a warmer atmosphere, we have a lot more moisture all the time. So when you get that heating or you get an orographic lift as the storms come up over the mountains, you get more precipitation out of that. And then combine warm air masses and cold air masses together, like your friends in Boston saw, and then you get those frontal systems that produce a lot more rain because you have a lot more moisture in those clouds.
Right. So there must be an upper limit to how much moisture a cloud can hold. Is there some sort of plateau effect that comes in? I mean, as we get warmer and warmer, will the clouds just hold more moisture?
I think that's the question that the scientists are working on right now. The people that do the research on this are trying to figure out, is it going to eventually have a large cloud cover over the atmosphere so the solar radiation doesn't heat the ground and cause these thunderstorms? What if we have more clouds all the time and we just have more of a Seattle-type air mass, but then we have more heat? And that's what they're trying to figure out right now. The question of is it happening and are we causing it was really answered a long time ago, about 4 or 5 years ago. That question's been answered. And if you talk to them, what are you working on? This is the question they're working on. How are the precipitation patterns going to hold? Because that's what we really want to know. The desert Southwest, is it going to have more prolonged drought periods with intense heat? And if that's the case, the vegetation's going to suffer. We're going to have a lot more problems. And then it's interspersed with these really big rain events, the flooding events that we saw in 2005 in St. George, 2010 in St. George, 2006 in southeast Utah, where you have these phenomenal rain events over 3 days, and then you have this massive flooding, it all goes away. But if you look at the average, you'd say we were above average for the year, but it only came in a very short period of time.
So all of these challenges, the severe rainstorms, the tornadoes, the polar vortex dipping down and grabbing those states, there is something which is possibly positive. NASA released yesterday some pictures showing warm water moving towards South America, and they had a bunch of other models, and the gist of it was that they quantified a 67% chance of El Nino coming back. Last visited us in 1997. El Nino could bring relief to California and could bring snow to northern Utah, but I think we were talking earlier, you said it's probably more likely southern Utah.
Yeah, what happens with El Nino is it gives you a flip-flop, at least in the western U.S. So areas that are typically warm and dry, like the desert Southwest, becomes cooler and wetter. And that's nice for that area. That's what they need. Unfortunately, the Pacific Northwest, which is normally cooler and wetter, becomes warmer and drier. Utah is right in the middle of these two areas. And when you look at the data, the signal calls for southern Utah to become cooler and wetter, which they need desperately because this is the third year now of below average runoff for those areas. And if this is the case, then that's great. But northern Utah, the signal is messy. If you looked at a graph for Alta and said, in El Nino years, did we do much better? It's kind of a scatter plot. Some years were better. Some years were not so good. It's because we're right in the middle of those two systems. California, on the other end, receives a great benefit during El Nino, during the winter months, because the jet stream comes directly across the Pacific very strongly and then hits the coastal range. And that works quite well for those areas.
But generally speaking, our big snow years here in Park City have been El Nino years.
Yeah, we've had some of the biggest years during El Nino years. So, and you really need a strong El Nino. We've had El Nino before where it's been a weak El Nino, and it really doesn't do much. And also, El Nino itself is changing and not behaving the way it used to because our atmosphere is different. We've got a different atmosphere that behaves differently now with El Nino. And the scientists that work on that in the NOAA labs in Boulder, they're trying to find a pattern of when El Nino comes, what it does, and what happens, and it's changing.
So not that we would leave behind the conversation about how to reduce our own impact on climate change, but really we need to recalibrate our entire society for what's ahead in terms of if we have less vegetation and more intense rainfall, we're going to have more flash floods and debris flows. How do we recalibrate what we do as we go through our everyday lives? And I imagine that's something that scientists like you are looking at.
Yeah. We're looking at a study right now at the National Weather Service office. Three of us are looking at this. We had debris flows coming off of mountain canyons, Little Cottonwood, Spanish Fork, American Fork Canyon, that were monstrous debris flows that came off, and they weren't burn scars. We anticipate we're going to get debris flows from burned areas from wildfire because the vegetation burns away, the soil gets baked, it has hydrophobicity, and then you get debris flows. We kind of expect that to happen. But when you have it just in normal terrain, you have to ask, what was different here? What changed? And we're looking at that right now, and I think that's a small-scale project over a bigger area. People on the coast are trying to figure out how this works, what they have to do in the future. Areas that are having their vegetation changed, it's moving farther north, it's moving farther up in elevation.
Right.
Animal behavior is different now, insects are changing. So we're all adapting right now to what we're seeing and trying to minimize damage from this. But it's kind of difficult because when you have these events that we're not used to and we're not set up for, I think we have to just adapt until we come up with a working solution for this. And I don't think anybody really has this right now.
Right. Last week we spoke with an interesting conservation biologist out of Boston University who's written a book about observations at Walden Pond they took Thoreau's writings and observations on time, things happened, you know, birds came back to the area. And just what you say, it's a very interesting study on how things are happening, usually 3 weeks earlier, 2 to 3 weeks earlier. But let's bring this home a little bit, Brian. I can't help, after looking at the landslide website that Rich Giroux of the Utah Geological Survey gave us, I'm fascinated with landslides. And when you look at, let's go out on Deer Valley Drive, there's that big retaining wall and there's some slumping above it. And they've talked from time to time about whether or not that retaining wall is failing. If we have a weather system that comes through and dumps an inordinate amount of moisture at one time, I mean, I saw it on the website, these in Baltimore, there was a landslide or a slumping that caused an entire street to just kind of fall off into the creek. But talk a little bit about what could happen in a place like that.
So what's holding that up right now is the sheer strength of that hillside, the soils, the root structure, everything is kind of held in place. And it works well. But then now what we've done is cut the toe of that slope away, and that ability, it's like if you're leaning up against the wall with your feet dug into the ground. Now let's make it so where your feet are, let's make it a little more slippery or take away some of your shear strength. And then the stress increases on that hillside. And I think this gets kind of out of my league, but what I know from intense rain events that we've seen, it tends to liquefy the soils. So your shear strength gets a little different. Things start to move around a little bit. If your vegetation stays the same, something else has to change. And usually it's that intense rainfall that brings these down. That could very well happen. I think you would need to talk to the engineers. But we're seeing that on road cuts all throughout the northern mountains, that we're getting debris flows coming off of perfectly stable slopes due to intense rainfall. And as we anticipate more intense rainfall in the future, and when we talk about the future, we're talking long term, you know, out to the end of the century, we're going to see more of these events. And how do you safeguard against that, as it seems somewhat random, like the debris flow we saw in Washington that wiped out whole communities? And could you have said that's going to happen? Well, if you look at the hillside, you'd say this is kind of a bad place to build your house. But in Utah, we're building homes all over the place now, very close to these hillsides, farther up into the alluvial fans, closer to the streams. And when we saw 26 houses fall into the Santa Clara River in St. George, they actually built those homes on river sediment. There was no historical landmarks. The Indians, when they had burial grounds, they didn't bury any of their ancestors in these grounds because they knew it was going to be shifting around. Yet we built homes right in there. When we got the very large event, the homes fell right into the river and were swept away.
Brian, it sounds intuitive, but I thought it was pretty good practical advice when we were talking to the gentleman last week about mudslides. And he said, well, you know, we asked him what you can do to protect yourself. And he said, well, if you're in an area that might be prone to that and it's raining like the dickens, don't have anybody sleeping in the basement or on the first floor. And I thought that was pretty good advice, because yeah, the stuff comes in, it stays low. Of course, a debris thing, if you have like a 300-ton boulder that comes through the house, there's not much you can do about that. But, yeah, but you know, I thought that was good mm-hmm. advice.
And that's our greatest worry at the Weather Service when we're warning for these. You can see it's you know, kind of a relaxed atmosphere until we start getting thunderstorms and you hear the banner go away, and then we start getting worried, because our greatest fear is these really nice homes that are built high up on the slopes right below a burn scar. These debris flows cut loose, and it looks like 1,000 cement trucks just unloaded all at once. And little kids sleep in the basement, so these things go down, they jump into the window well, they break the window, they come into the room and slam the door shut, and then fill the room up with mud within 10 seconds. So if there's a little kid in there, he's stuck, and he can't get out of there. And I actually gave a presentation to some of the people in Corner Canyon area by Draper, saying just that. And luckily, they had a house that had just that happen. The kids were in the next room. So when the door slammed, they were in the next room. It was leaking under the door and filling up the room. They got out of the house, got in the car, and drove away. But we see this frequently. And we worry all the time that they're going to have little kids sleeping in there. So when we give these presentations to the communities, take your kids out of the basement. If you see it black up on the hillside, it's raining like crazy, get in the car, go get ice cream. Don't wait for an official warning or an official evacuation. Take the power in your own hands. Take a look at the place. We gave out these plastic rain gauges to the people who live there and said, if you see a half an inch in about 30 minutes, you should get in your car and just take a drive away. You can replace all the stuff, but you can't replace your family. And I think that was good information, as Rich pointed out last week. I've worked
great
with Rich
advice
on these. Yeah, it's really good advice.
Yeah.
That's right. So you would actually be able to pretty well calculate how much rainfall and what amount of time. Did you say a half inch in
30 minutes?
In 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And then you also have kept enough data on the soils around these places that are, you know, the places you worry about, Corner Canyon and American and Spanish Fork as
yep.
well. So you're able to really say to these people when it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And they just need to heed your warning.
And fortunately for me, I've been able to get on these teams after the burn. That fire is actually going still. It's almost out. And it's a post-burn team of physical scientists, soil scientists, botanists. And I go on as the hydrologist. There's other hydrologists and there's engineers. And we get a game plan and we survey the hillside. Do we take soil samples? We see how hot it burned. What was the residence time of the fire? Was there hydrophobicity? And that's basically the soil gets cooked, so it acts like a Gore-Tex jacket, and it all runs off. And if it's hot burn, long residence time, absence of vegetation, then we lower that number a little bit for amount of rain that will cause a debris flow. And we do this analysis for about a week, and then we come off. And my end is done. I go back and talk to the meteorologist at the Weather Service and say, if you see rain of a half an inch in a half an hour over this burn scar, we need to call the municipalities, call the sheriff, and then issue a flash flood warning, which goes out to all the media. And then we have a game plan ready to go. And it worked really well because the Forest Service allowed me to be part of their teams. You know, I'm a Weather Service hydrologist. I don't work for the Forest Service, but they were nice enough to do that. And I've been on multiple teams now that I've got a feel for how this worked, because before we did this, we weren't very good at it. We just didn't know what went on the ground. And in the office of staff with the meteorologists, who would look at the amount of rain coming down. But the ground is a big part of this.
So many fatalities seem to be from people that refuse to leave their homes.
Yeah.
They just they don't want to leave.
No, and I don't know why. I don't understand that. In the face of what's above you, it can be pretty scary. Like when I gave that talk, the lady who had the mud come into her house was honest with me and said, I just thought you were kind of an alarmist. You were just kind of blowing smoke. And I wondered that. But maybe you hear so many things in our society today, how we have so many warnings that are just for legal terms. You know,
yeah.
Maybe they get desensitized by this. But when you do see something that's pretty scary and you try and get the message across, I don't know if it really goes so well.
I think that's a good point. There are at least two major news channels that are 24/7, the sky is falling. I'm not just talking about weather, you know,
yeah.
They're just, you know, everything. And,
yeah.
And maybe we've become insensitive to warnings.
Right. You know, here's a thought. Say every summer, you know, my family goes camping up in that favorite camp spot up in the Uintas, and, you know, it's in a floodplain. But we've been there every year on the, you know, Pioneer Day for decades, and we've withstood some big rainfall, you know.
Yeah.
It may be this sort of thing, but we haven't seen the intense rain events before that we're seeing now, and that's where the awareness needs to come.
Yeah.
And also, it's where people, you know, they're going to these places that they've been. This is the same with the people in Washington. I mean, they didn't
yeah.
heed warnings necessarily because maybe they thought, well, it hasn't ever happened. It's not going to happen.
And it's an assumption of risk. How much risk are you willing to deal with? I mean, if you didn't want any risk, you'd stay in your house and you wouldn't have any fun at all. And in this
yeah.
community, how we all ski so much, the more fun it is to ski the steeper slopes and the scarier slopes. And when you go out in the backcountry with the avalanche conditions, it's very similar. How much risk are you willing to assume? Like, and for your family that went to this really nice campground, your risk was probably quite low. That the outlier storm happens infrequently, but maybe since we're changing our atmosphere, we're getting more intense rain events, your assumption of risk now became a little greater. It's still probably pretty small, that the probability that you're going to get hit with this is still small, that you really should go and be ready, be aware of what's going on. But now that we've done things, like we've built higher up into the alluvial fans, we've gotten closer to the streams, and then even say we burn the hillside above us, now your assumption of risk is much greater. And you really have to pay attention or take action and be ready to that, have a mindset to do that. And I think we'll see more of that as time continues with climate change.
Let's talk some specifics about the Rockport fire last year. What do those residents need to be aware of this year?
So the Rockport fire burned hot in a couple of areas where there's hydrophobicity located. And what we'll see is
that's a great word, by the way.
Yeah.
Think of it as a Gore-Tex jacket on the hillside that doesn't allow rainfall to infiltrate. So what happens is now you've burned off the vegetation, so you don't have that layer of protection from the physics of a raindrop that comes screaming out of the sky. And before it used to hit the vegetation and slow that energy down. We've burned that off. Now what we have is this raindrop hitting the soil, and it's dislodging a piece of soil. That soil is now dislodging two. That two is dislodging four. And an exponential movement is now happening at the upper drainage. Now you've got this, the hillside is moving in this area, and it has nothing to hold it back because the root structure is gone. So you have this kind of mud debris sliding down the hill. If your home is below, you have a problem. But fortunately, for the road that's right below Rockport, the road cut is so high compared to where it all ends up down in the bottom. It's going to clog the drain big time. The culvert that goes under there is just going to be totally – but I don't think it's going to cross the road and go into the reservoir or knock cars off. It's the road cut is so big. And the homes that are located, they're kind of strategically around that I think you'd really need a really localized debris flow to come right through the house. So we looked at this hillside and thought our risk level is low for this because the road, we don't anticipate being impacted. And the homeowners that live there are positioned in such a way that it's not high-density housing that they're kind of scattered around there. And they kind of know the score. And hopefully they'll be aware of thunderstorm activity and take action on their own.
Brian, I want to go back to something we were talking about earlier about the atmosphere being warm or being able to contain and hold more moisture. With the salinity decreasing in the seas, or will be decreasing with the melt-off of Antarctic sheets in the west and also Greenland, will evaporation be increasing as well?
Yeah, anytime you've warmed any surface, water surface, you're going to get increased evaporation. And this goes back to the whole, what's going to happen with the global circulation of precipitation and what does the ocean, how much evaporation are you going to get with an increased warmed ocean? And we talked about El Nino. Well, the actual average temperature in that area that we look at El Nino has actually gone up. They've raised the level that would say this is average temperature because the oceans have warmed so much that we would be in an El Nino all the time where the oceans are right now. So they had to raise the average temperature to say, okay, now this is the level that we'll see El Nino because the oceans are so much warmer. And the scientists, when I've talked to them that do this research, worry that with that increased evaporation, that we're going to see more hurricanes and more intense storms in the ocean that will start moving on land. They don't have it down yet. They're still working on it. And it's a big worry because, you know, we're increasing all this frequency.
And ocean levels also rise as the temperature warms. I think that's how they figure out if the ocean's warming or not, by looking at the sea levels, right?
Yeah, well, there's two parts to that. When you look at Greenland, Greenland has its ice on a continent. So it's like if we put we fill this room up with water, but we put a bunch of ice on the table, and we melted that ice. Now it goes off the table and into the water in the room, so it's going to rise. Whereas Arctic ice is in the water itself, so they don't anticipate that's going to warm. But Antarctica is on a continent. That's going to rise. And then when that does, when you've increased the amount of just fresh water into it, it changes the ocean currents now and where we typically see jets and that type of thing.
Okay. Before we let you go, Brian, and it's always so great to have you because we could keep you here for the entire hour, but just give us a quick synopsis of snowpack. We had some snow last week. Did it help? What are we looking ahead at for the summer?
So our snowpack was close to normal about the third week of February. But then we hit March and April, which were dry for the most part. Our snowpack is still remaining up there. We have some to come off. We'll have the biggest flows in about the next week for starting and some of the smaller drainages. And then we'll see the bigger flows come about the end of May. And then we should be done with the runoff by at least early June. And we'll be done. Our water supply for this area is okay. It could be better, but if you have areas that have low elevation drainages, they're not doing too well. So overall, below average runoff and below average volume, we won't fill Jordanelle. We probably won't fill Deer Creek, and most of the other reservoirs will get close. If they're smaller, they should fill. If they're larger, they won't fill.
And unfortunately, we are running out of time. But I had just a really quick question. If you could answer.
Okay.
In the Northeast, we have our nor'easters. We have really hard pounding snowstorms, but never have we had thunder during the snowstorms. Out here, you get thunder. Why is that?
I think it's because we get convection with these storms, embedded thunderstorms in a snowstorm, rising air currents that come up that do the same process in summertime thunderstorms. And a lot of it's due to the mountains, because we have a lot of moving air that's hitting the mountains and then rising. And then when it does that, it separates the charges and you get that static discharge.
And you call that snow thunder.
Yeah, it's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming out. Will you come out and visit us again?
Sure, absolutely. Always love this.
Well, thanks to Brian McInerney for being our guest today and for this fun conversation. We're going to take a quick break for our underwriters. And when we return, we'll be talking with Zeng Zeng, an assistant professor of physics of astronomy at the University of Utah. We'll be talking to him about hypervelocity stars. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Stand Up Utah is a mad dash of stand-up, bringing five of Utah's best comedians to one stage in one night. They may perform nationally, but they come from the place that inspires comedy as we all live it. Share their perspective. Blow out some laughs. Enjoy a night of quick wit with Stand Up Utah at the Egyptian Theater, Thursday, May 15th. Tickets, just $15 and up at parkcityshows.com or 649-9371. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization.
A longtime supporter of KPCW, Jan's Mountain Outfitters sells and rents mountain bikes and road bikes. Our bike shop provides bike fitting, parts, tunes, and repair service. Jan's Fly Shop is stocked with fishing gear and offers guided fishing excursions and lessons, serving Park City for over 30 years. 649-4949 or jans.com.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, we just spoke with Brian McInerney, hydrologist for the National Weather Service. Our next guest, Zeng Zeng, is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah. Zeng is the lead author of the study published recently in Astrophysical Journal Letters by a team of U.S. and Chinese astronomers. In the past decade, astronomers have found about 20 of these odd stars. They're hypervelocity stars. They appear to be remaining pairs of binary stars that once orbited each other and got too close to the supermassive black hole at the galaxy's center. Intense gravity from the black hole, which has the mass of 4 million stars like our sun, captures one star, so it orbits the hole closely and slingshots the other on a trajectory headed beyond the galaxy. Zen, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi,
thanks for joining us. And, just reading this introduction for the kind of work you do makes it sound, pretty otherworldly. And I'm wondering how you, as a professor, first of all, how do you explain all that you study in lay terms to your students or on a program like this?
For this type of stars, we study, this star has, the property of this star is that they have really high velocity, so really high speed. So the speed is so high that, in the future, the star, can escape our Milky Way galaxy. And so we discovered this star, from, a survey of the Milky Way galaxy stars, with a big telescope. And this telescope is located in China, and it's called LAMOS. So it's big. So the mirror has a diameter about 13 feet. And the unique thing about this telescope is basically it's equipped with 4,000 fibers. Okay, so this 4,000 fibers means that, you know, we can take the spectra. Okay, the spectra of stars means that the light of star has different wavelengths. So basically, we can take spectra of about 4,000 stars at once. So it's a very powerful telescope. So we take like a spectra of many, many stars. And from the spectra, we can figure out a lot of things about the stars. You know, like, you know, the brightness of stars, the size, the mass, the temperature, and the more importantly for this study is the velocity. So we figure out the velocity of stars. We observed about, like, you know, 100,000 stars. And we try to search for this rare object with high velocity. And then we are lucky. We found right. one.
So, Zhang, we have observed this very small part of the universe. And yep. in our observation, we kind of figure out how much mass we think is required to support these observations. And there's not enough mass out there. So we've come up with this theory of dark matter that we think – comprises 80% of the universe, but we really don't know much about it. Now, the dark matter is housed where this halo is, where we're trying to understand better. What do we know about dark matter?
Yeah, so what do we know about dark matter? So, first of all, we don't know what dark matter is. Okay, that's a big mystery, you know, in astronomy and also in physics. So we are working to study, you know, dark matter. But what we do know is that dark matter has gravity, so it basically can interact with like stars through the gravitation interaction. Okay, so and also we know the dark matter, like it besides the except for the gravitational interaction, so other type of interaction are really weak. Basically, we can pass through the dark matter halo without any friction. But we do feel the gravitational effect from dark matter.
Okay.
So that's basically how we infer that there must exist dark matter in the universe.
Why do we call it dark matter? I mean, couldn't it be a type of gravity that we don't understand yet?
Oh, that's a really good question. In fact, yeah. So there's another, shadow theory. Basically, okay, in fact, there's no dark matter, but in fact, our understanding about the gravity is not complete. But from all kinds of observations, seems that dark matter, once we introduce this dark matter, basically many things fall into together, and we can explain many things. Seems that the dark matter is a more natural thing in the theory than a modified gravity.
Yeah, it seems like the one thing in common over all of our discoveries over many, many, many years is surprise. We're constantly surprised at what is out there in this universe. And I know we're trying to account for these observations that we've observed with gravitational pull. And there could be a completely different type of gravity out there. We just don't understand at all.
Yeah, that's possible, but the thing that, if you introduce this kind of theory, you need to explain a lot of things. It is really hard for the modified gravity to explain everything. But, dark matter seems to be very natural to explain, a lot of different observations. That's why, we have a strong belief that, we find the evidence of dark matter rather than, modified gravity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So, is there anything else you want to tell us about your discoveries?
Sure. Okay. So, this star, we found this one star. So this star moves with, really high velocity. So, if we try to observe from a solar system, velocity is about 1.5 million miles per hour. If we observe from the galactic center, it's about 1 million miles per hour. So it's really high velocity. So just try to connect the velocity to what we are familiar with. Basically, the star it travels about 16,000 times faster than a car. okay, or about like 1,600 times faster than a plane.
Right.
And if you imagine that, you know, we could fly at such a speed, so basically we could circle around the Earth in just about 90 seconds, okay? Or we can fly to the moon within like 15 minutes. So it's right. really fast.
Yes, exactly. We are speaking this morning with Zheng Zheng, an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah. And Zheng is a lead author and works with a number of people, University of Utah, on these fascinating hypervelocity stars. Zheng, we want to thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We will be back after these messages.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open 7 days a week starting at noon for lunch, après-ski, dinner, drinks, and dancing. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. We are just speaking with Zheng Zheng of the University of Utah about that hypervelocity star, interesting work that he's doing there. But we wanted to save some time for to re-air an interview from last hour. Now, we wanted to speak to these girls on Cool Science Radio, no doubt in a couple weeks when they come back from the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair. We will get them on to tell us more about their experiment. And I don't even think I should call it an experiment because they've tested it. They've built a prototype. It's Elizabeth Prucka and Maddie Reed. Elizabeth's a sophomore. Maddie's a junior at Park City High School. These girls are knocking it out of the park, let me tell you. They're at, as I said, the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair, and it is 1,700 kids from around the world, 70 different countries who are here. They're all going to share $4 million in prizes and scholarships. But wait till you hear about the sheer thickening non-Newtonian fluid that these two girls have developed to create an armor that will protect those in the military from bullets, knives, any kind of blows. And it's, go ahead.
Lynn, there's a pattern emerging here. We've had more young ladies on our show that are kicking butts in science and technology. This is pretty cool.
It really is. It absolutely is. And actually, interestingly enough, there are five students from Utah at this International Science Fair, two from Park City. There's another girl from St. George. There's another girl from North Ogden. The only male is Hans Pandel. He's from Salt Lake City. But again, as you said, girls are entering into the world of science, technology, and engineering at a much faster pace, and it's really heartening to see. So I am going to go ahead and air that interview from last hour. It's fascinating.
I'll be right here.
Well, I'll let them tell you about it, but it starts off with being a sheer thickening non-Newtonian fluid, and that's probably lost most of us adults out there. Good morning to you, Maddie and Elizabeth.
Good morning.
So I have you both there. Good. Okay, first of all, just tell us what your project is and maybe do it for the lay people, you know, those of us who haven't been in physics in the last couple decades.
All right, sounds good. So this is Maddie, by the way. So the principle behind it is exactly as you said, a sheer thickening non-Newtonian fluid. And it works kind of like the combination of cornstarch and water. When you move it around really fast, when you apply a lot of force, the material becomes more viscous. But when you let it kind of relax, it becomes less viscous. So we can apply it to different materials, like, say, Kevlar. And let's say a bullet is fired. We can use this principle to protect against a bullet, but not add really significant bulk or weight to a fabric.
Ah, very good. So say it was a slow-moving bullet, it might not activate, right?
No, but there are other types of non-Newtonian fluids that would be able to interact with slow-moving bullets.
Okay, and so to what degree have you developed this product, and how are you demonstrating this for the science competition that you're at?
We've done quite a bit of testing with a single layer of what would be our final product, and we have developed a prototype of what we would make. It is currently not a whole vest. This is Elizabeth, by the way, sorry.
Yes.
And so we've made approximately a foot-by-foot square of what would be our final prototype, and we have tested it. So,
and so how do you test it?
We have a 9mm, actually. We have a ballistics gel, which we can shoot from, and we compare it to the same square of our untreated armor, and so we can look at the results in the penetration.
Go ahead.
So we test it with, we've just recently been testing it with actual firearms, but in the beginning we started out, we brainstormed some things that everyday soldiers need to be protected from. And we decided they need to be protected from flames. They need to be protected from, let's say, knife or puncture wounds, and, of course, bullets. So we started by testing with testing flammability and testing to see how well a knife penetrates it and how well pellets from, like, a pellet gun would penetrate it. So.
Right. So how could this material potentially be an upgrade from what is currently out there on the market?
So the current standard for military protection right now is a heavy ceramic-style plate surrounded by layers of Kevlar. And the plate, there are a few drawbacks with the plate. It's really, really heavy. It's really, really expensive to make. It's not flexible, so it can only be used to cover the torso, and it's only designed to sustain one hit and disperse it laterally before becoming compromised. So if you have a fluid instead as an armor, it's a lot lighter. It'd be flexible, so you could use it to protect your extremities. And it's a fluid, so you could get shot in one spot, and the fluid would kind of cover to protect that area, and then you could get shot in the same place. And because it's a fluid, it would flow to the areas where it's needed.
This is just amazing. And girls, we're going to let you go. I know we have a busy, or you have a busy day ahead. Today is the day for judging. This sounds, it's unbelievable, unfathomable to me that you guys could come up with this as high school students. Really, it's amazing. Congratulations to you. And what do you think your chances are?
Well, I suppose we'll see. I'm happy with our project. I think we've really worked on it, but I mean, we'll never know. So,
yeah, judging here is so crazy, and it's just really an honor to be here with all these different people. I think there are people from 70 different countries here. So meeting everybody, it's really great.
That's right. 1,700 young scientists and engineers from 70 countries. I've got to think this project and being at the fair is going to kind of write you your ticket to college and scholarship and all kinds of things.
Well, that would be an added bonus.
Well, best of luck to you. So you'll know after today kind of how you all fared, and then you'll be returning home?
Yes. Grand Awards is tomorrow morning, and we should find out how we did there.
All right. Well, best of luck to you. We'd love for you to come back and talk to us more when you get back. So congratulations and best of luck today.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, that was Elizabeth Prucka and Maddie Reed from Park City High School at that Intel International Science and Engineering Fair. And wow, what a couple of girls. That's a cool project.
It really is. It really is.
And not only is it a great project, it's something that can be developed and marketed. And, you know, it sounds like it may be cost prohibitive, at least in the beginning, but isn't everything in the beginning?
Yeah, and it also reminds me of the girls that we interviewed that had won the robotics competition. And even though robotics were involved, their whole thing was about purifying water in Malaysia. And it's just interesting.
That's right. And as we said before, there are five students from Utah at this competition. One of them is a boy, and his project is a sustainable third world water purification system. It can purify water at the rate of 3 gallons per minute. And I don't know if you've ever, you know, been out camping where you have to purify water. Those things take forever.
Oh, they do.
So this is 3 gallons a minute is quite something. Another one, Tessa Carver from North Ogden, she did a kind of a sociological study. It's interesting. She studied the relationship between self-perception and an educator's decision to intervene in bullying situations. And it goes on, but that's interesting as a science experiment. And then Brooklyn Morris from St. George, her project has to do with cryopreservation, so freezing things at sub-zero temperatures to freezing cells, tissues, or any other substances with sub-zero temperatures, and how that will benefit as, you know, we move forward in the world with population growth and freezing food and preserving things for longer periods of time. So very interesting. These kids are amazing. I love it.
They really are. They really are. You know, you mentioned that thing about bullying, and I apologize, I don't have more information on it, but there was a soundbite on just a couple of days ago where there was a study over, I think it was like a 20 or 25 year period, and they found that kids that were bullied had continued health challenges throughout their life, and the people that did the bullying seemed to fare better, a lot better. And I wish I had that information.
I don't know what I think about that study. That's not...
Yeah, I don't like it
either.
Yeah,
it's not good, but interesting.
We're just talking about bullying. You know, we should do a quick, cool science story. And, of course, Brian McInerney, we could have spoken with him a couple hours anyway. But, we're talking about severe weather and droughts and polar vortexes. Well, when we think about California and the drought that they're experiencing right now, they have also determined that fracking has something to do with contributing to drought. So they're considering some moratoriums, and they actually have moratoriums in place in a number of cities in California.
Well, I find it interesting because if you ever hear anything about the Central Valley, California, where a lot of the nation's food comes from, all they talk about is the disappearance of water. I can't believe that they would allow fracking for even a second there.
Yeah.
So I would imagine, and I've heard this story come out on NPR recently and in the news, that there's no way farmers are going to allow fracking to happen. And I would imagine residents would support that.
Of course, you're wrestling with big business and lobbyists and deep pockets and all the political stuff that we have so much fun in this country with. Hopefully they can do that. And then back, of course, on the other coast, New York currently has a temporary moratorium on fracking. So,
as do other areas.
Yeah.
This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. Lowe Stump Tree Service, Park City's Local Tree Care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And we want to thank our sponsors, San Francisco Design, Prudential Real Estate, Peak Art and Frame, and our new sponsor, Nexus IT. You're listening to KPCW, Park City.